This is an encore presentation of Unreserved. Enjoy!
The Nishu Manituk, as we say in Anishinaabemowin, that was how that name was given to me. And it's taken its own journey around the world. And there are a number of us who want to slow down, come back, and to be able to bring an understanding and not a definition, because it cannot be defined.
Nizo Manituk, or Two Spirit, is the name specific to Indigenous people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer. We have always been here, but our return journey through the name Two Spirit began just over 30 years ago with Anishinaabe elder Myra Laramie.
The grandfathers came in a dream. The grandmothers showed all of us the gift and the greatness of Two Spirit. Seven orbs of light. As I was standing out on the grass, it was like the teepee disappeared and everything that, except the tobacco in my hand and the way in which I could see them through those legislature lights, they came one after the other, seven of them. And each time one came, there was a male face and a female face that would transform back and forth. And the first time the grandpa came, the Mushum face came, he said, "You are as of us. You are one of us. And you have been here like us since the beginning of time. And you have come to know which way and how we travel the earth and the sky world and the spirit world." And he said, "You will begin to know many different kinds of things about the Two-Spirit nation. It's a nation of many means and many gifts and many ways. But your gift is to see the world always in two sights, with two feelings of the heart. It's neither male or female, but it's both. It's neither up or down, but it's in the middle. It's a complex understanding, but it's a real understanding if you just let yourself simmer down and not try to be something you're not." And so in that engagement of spirit and heart, we will always know who we are. It will never be taken away from us again, ever, 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 ever.
Say Anin, Buju, hello and welcome to Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. The term Two-Spirit was created in 1990. As we just heard, Elder Myra Laramie was given the name in a dream. She took it to the annual gathering of Indigenous LGBTQ people who adopted the term. At first, it meant someone who carries both feminine and masculine energy, or spirits. But it has since evolved to recognize the many genders and sexual identities within Indigenous communities. I first discovered the term while on my own journey of exploring my sexuality. I had only moved to Winnipeg recently, and while I eventually found my way to the Rainbow community, something was still missing. I didn't really see my Indigenousness represented in the LGBTQ family. I felt a bit lonely. So when I found out about Two-Spirit people, I finally found the place that I belonged. I was home. Today on Radio Indigenous, meet Indigenous people who walk that journey loud and proud, claiming Two-Spirit identity and reclaiming their place in cultural and community circles. Back when when I first moved to the big city, oh, about 20 or so years ago, one of the first friends I made was Alex Wilson. I was in my 20s and only just coming out, or as Alex says, coming in. That's a term she coined. Alex has a doctorate of education in psychology. She's devoted her career to understanding two-spirit identity, how it's rooted in the land, and why coming in as a two-spirit person is a uniquely Indigenous experience. Welcome to the show, Alex, my friend.
Nancy, hello. I'm honored to be here.
Well, let's begin with getting to know you a little bit. You grew up in the Opaskwayak Cree Nation in Manitoba. What was your experience growing up as someone who is attracted to the same gender?
Well, great question, and going back a long way. But yeah, I'm from Opaskwayak Cree Nation, and you know, I always thought that I just had this normal kind of childhood, playing outside and building forts and, you know, trapping little animals, you know, as we were taught when we were little. And in many ways, it was normal. But it's when I went to school that I started to see that maybe I was a bit different than other kids.
Yeah. And what were those instances where you realized that you were being treated differently?
One of the first things I remember is we lived in town for a year. And so I was able to walk home for lunch at lunchtime. And one time I was invited home. This was in grade one, by one of my classmates, because she got a new paint set. And we got to her house, and before we went in, she said, "Oh, wait here, I have to ask if you're allowed in," which I thought, okay, that's all right. So she went in and asked her grandma if I could come in. And then she came out and said, "Oh, sorry. My grandma said there's no Indians allowed in the house."
Oh, wow.
So at that point, I recognized and understood, like on a emotional, visceral level, that there was something about my identity and my family and my community that wasn't being seen as equal. And I guess today we would call those microaggressions. Mm. So many of us have like many, many examples of those. But later on, when I was a bit older, like maybe 10 or 11, we had on OCN, we had these like community dances that they weren't powwows, but they were just get togethers. And everyone was kind of dancing, and the elders are sitting around the edge, kind of watching and clapping and visiting. And one of my little friends stopped me from dancing and said, "Oh, quit dancing like a boy." So I stopped and I thought, okay, well, what does that mean? What is that? You know?
Yeah. How am I dancing like a boy?
Yeah. So I understood that maybe she was trying to protect me, or maybe she was trying to regulate me. But the impact was that I internalized that there was something wrong with the way that I was just being myself. Mm. But the other thing that happened at that same time was that the elders were watching and they just said, "Oh, never mind, just be yourself." Mm-hmm. So there was that kind of narrative that I internalized as well.
Yeah.
And then by the time I got to high school, I recognized that not only was there kind of a gender monitoring going on and racial kind of, well, racism, mm-hmm. and that it also included sexuality. And I always wore hockey skates at home. Like, we had a little creek behind our house, so I played hockey all the time. And so in high school, when we had skating, I brought my hockey skates, and the teacher said to me, "Well, you can't wear boys' skates because people will think you're a dyke."
Mm.
And so that was kind of jarring, but also that was a galvanizing moment for me when I realized that there is an interconnection of all these forms of oppression that are continually being negotiated by us as two-spirit people, even though I'm pretty sure that teacher was a dyke herself. But that's for another discussion.
We're going to have to call her after the show and see what's going on.
Yeah. There. So my experiences helped me kind of understand the bigger picture, I guess, and also always being cognizant of these forces that were happening in society,
yeah,
and how they're enacted on us as people.
And when you say, you know, galvanized you and you realized the big picture? How did recognizing that those very three very serious things and things that might take others a while to figure out, how did that treatment affect how you interacted with the world?
The way I did it, I mean, there's healthy ways and then there's not so healthy ways. So, I mean, you internalize these messages and you think like you're just not good enough. But then also, and I think this is where the connection to culture and land comes in, is that that always gives you a place to be connected to, so that you are always a part of that. And, you know, even the way that we introduce ourselves has to do with how we're connected through our umbilical cord to the land. So Pascuayaco Chinina is like where my umbilical cord connects, so that that we have that place and that connection, that relationship that that is positive.
Yeah. And I definitely want to unpack that deepness there. You're getting a little deep on me here. But let's back it up a little and explore what this term that we're talking about today, this idea, this concept, this identity, two-spirit. What does the term two-spirit mean as you understand it?
Well, I know there's a lot of variation on what it means, but in general, I think the term is a self-descriptor that's used by Indigenous people to recognize that there's a diversity of sexuality and gender within our cultures. So if you're talking about a circle, which is often the model that's used as an example or as, you know, as the framework, there are two sides to a circle. There's being in the circle and there's not being in the circle.
True that.
So, you know, there's a whole range of diversity within humans.
Right.
And two-spirit recognizes and validates that. So it's a modern term that recognizes our ancient understandings of our identity.
Oh, I love how you put that. That is the beautiful way to put it. In fact, you wrote one of the first studies on the term several, let's say a couple decades ago, give or take, on the term two-spirit and what it means to Indigenous people. What did you find in that very early study?
Yeah, well, just to give the context for why I started doing the research, wasn't really just to understand my own life, but more about how, given all the sustained homophobia, transphobia, sexism, misogyny, and racism, how do we stay empowered? And there was a significant event that happened when I was finishing my undergrad. And as you mentioned, I went to Sacramento State to finish my undergrad. And while I was there, I worked as a youth group facilitator for a LGBTQ rap group. Basically, it was youth that came together and just talked every Friday. And I came back here over the summer, as I always did, and then went back in the fall for my last semester of my undergrad. And when I got back, I went to the youth group and I noticed that none of the Indigenous kids were there. And there were quite a few of them. And I asked, what happened to RJ? What happened to so-and-so? And over the course of the summer, all of them had committed suicide. And for me, that was obviously, it was devastating. It was traumatic. And it took a while to kind of process and heal from that. But it also made me realize and wonder, like, what is happening in the world that is making this place unsafe for us to be ourselves? And so that was the first kind of time that I started looking into what research was out there. And there was no research written by or informed even by Indigenous queer people.
So when you were looking, you're saying that there was nobody had bothered to ask Indigenous people about this? Is this what you
Well, found? There were a lot of anthropological studies dating back even to the 1930s. And it was all from their kind of lens and understanding, which really brought a binarized kind of European lens or understanding to our cultures. And so a lot of the findings that they had were really more about a reflection of what they needed in European culture, because many of them were actually gay men looking for something that their culture didn't have, or really idealizing, romanticizing, and to some degree fetishizing our cultures. And so the findings really weren't helpful at all for us to understand how systemic forms of oppression work. So then I decided to go to graduate school and actually made a commitment to focus on this for my research and have since then. And so obviously the answers have to come from our communities.
You're listening to Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. My guest is Alex Wilson, a good friend of mine who has devoted her academic career to understanding two-spirit identity.
So I did a pilot study, and then I did my dissertation research, which was with people that self-identified as two-spirit, mostly from Manitoba, and they were either Anishinaabe, Cree, or Métis.
And what did you find when you spoke with these two-spirit people?
The participants in that study, had some common experiences, and one is that they had a place when they were growing up, and then there were things that happened that kind of fragmented or fractured their connections. And some of them had to hide parts of who they were, whether it was their sexuality or their gender, or for some even their ethnic background or their culture, their language. And then all came to a place eventually where they were able to find and create community that supported them and in a powerful, beautiful way.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that's the story I just said in your intro, is that when I met you, you were so gentle in guiding me into the community. And in fact, you created and discovered, or whatever, I'm not going to say Columbus, because this is a brand new concept created by Alex, called Coming In. Share with us what that means.
Yeah, well, it was my friend Wayne Baboon, who was in the pilot study, who first actually, you know, brought that term forward, and then we discussed it more, and then realized that this is what people were describing, this process of coming in. So coming in really was not a declaration or an announcement like coming out would be,
yeah,
but rather an affirmation of this interdependent identity. People who are LGBTQ, two-spirit, come to an understanding of their relationship to, you know, their place and value in their own families, community, culture, history, and the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
Coming into the circle.
Yes, coming into the circle, the community, this idea that you are part of a bigger place, I guess.
Absolutely.
How is coming in different from coming out?
Well, coming out is an individual identity, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, da, 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 here I am, you know, I've reached the pinnacle of, you know, I'm coming out.
wait, dance break.
Tried to get some Cher in here, but.
Absolutely. Well. She is our goddess. Yes.
Yes. So it really aligns with kind of the American kind of Canadian dream, you know, where you're just so independent and there on your own and you've made it despite all these struggles. Right. So it's like your independent journey. And I mean, that is important. I don't want to dismiss that, but coming in, I think really works for a relational worldview, which our communities are centered around. It fits within our cosmology, our place within the wider universe.
Yeah.
And on the higher spiritual kind of level, it makes so much sense that we are a part of something bigger. It's the implicate order of life, really.
I like that. Let's dig into a little deeper into that order. Much of your work centers around, as I had said, two-spirit identity, body sovereignty, and queering land-based education. So I'm super excited to learn what that is. What do you mean when you talk about body sovereignty and queering land-based education?
Yeah, well, body sovereignty is like having control over our own bodies rather than being regulated. So we know that colonization, a big part of it was through policy, practice, procedure. Every aspect of our lives were regulated. So body sovereignty is like coming from a different approach where we have sovereignty over our own bodies. It's just as simple as that. And then queering, I always quote my dear friend, Dr. Kalani Young, a Kanaka Maoli Hawaiian scholar, who says that queering is transforming poison into medicine. And so that poison is colonization, obviously, right? And so just being ourselves is a form of queering. And it's a form of land acknowledgement. It's such an important thing for us to be able to be ourselves. But for many people in different points of our lives, we are not allowed to be ourselves. And and so the queering is recognizing that we have valid knowledge and knowledge systems as Indigenous people. And as I mentioned, that we're part of our cosmology, like our origin and creation stories. We exist in all of those stories. So queering is getting those, our stories back, reclaiming them, figuring out how to reconstruct them in a way that makes sense to the diversity of human life. And, you know, many of our practices and our stories, when they're translated into English, they're put into a framework of heteropatriarchy where, you know, there's a hierarchy, there's power, there's control. And over and over again, we see that women and queer two-spirit people are kind of left out of the story, which is not the case in real life. We're here, we're in the fabric of society, we're in every family, we're in every community, we're here, we're queer. Get used to it.
Where's my picket?
Yeah. So that's what queering is. And to me, I love queering. You know, decolonization is a real popular and it's a very important kind of form of scholarship. Queering is theory, but it's also action. Mm. And like, rather than centering colonization, queering centers like the queer, the queer in it. And it's not like making everybody into queer people, but it is more about the bigger picture of twisting, understanding, turning things around, going back to and trying to figure out where things went awry and then going back to those original stories and how did those become heteropatriarchal.
Now, young people seem to be discovering their identities and all the ways to express themselves at an earlier and earlier age. Where do you think they will lead us? Do you think that this will mean more people coming into the circle to make it complete?
I hope so. You know, one of the most challenging things and sad things for me to recognize is that in all these years of doing this research, you know, since 1994, really, in my undergrad, the suicide rates for queer Indigenous people, not just youth people, have not decreased.
Mm.
So despite youth being so open about their identities today, there's still these things that are happening in society that make the world not a safe place. But I think now, like, if as we build that circle stronger, that will be the norm, or that can be the norm. And I see youth challenging older people, even though it's out of their comfort zone, on practices that are exclusionary or that are harmful to youth or to two-spirit bodies. I think that you know, some people are having coming in ceremonies now, which I think is beautiful, and they're saying, like, if we can't find a place within our own ceremonial groups, then we're going to create our own. Wow, that's powerful. Mm-hmm. You know, that takes a lot of courage, and I support them in that. So
I love it. Coming in ceremonies. Let's have them from now on, right next to the Moon Lodge. Alex, thank you so much for joining us today. What an amazing conversation. You're the smartest person I know.
Thank you, Rosanna.
Alex Wilson is from the Opaskwayak Cree Nation in Manitoba and is a professor in the College of Education at the University of Saskatchewan. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we are spending some time with our two spirit cousins. Later, Joshua Whitehead will be here, self-described, indigiqueer, and author of the novel Johnny Appleseed.
I just remember thinking about, like, this is exactly who I am, that I'm both, you know, an OG Cree diehard, but then I'm also a queer femme who, you know, like, likes to wear booty shorts and shake it at the club.
That's coming up. So what does coming in look like in practice? Chantal Fiola and Nikki Ferland are a Métis couple who live in Winnipeg. They recently walked that talk all the way down the aisle.
You know, honestly, for a long time, I didn't want to get married. I had seen the influence of Euro-Christian patriarchy and the things you're expected to internalize in, like, mainstream Western culture just didn't sit right with me. But then when I started going to ceremonies like 15 years ago and learned about these beautiful Wita'gaewin teachings and learning that what we call two-spirit people have always existed in most Indigenous nations, and that we were and are welcome to love and participate in these ceremonies, I then started imagining and dreaming about finding my wife and, you know, raising a family and making sure that these teachings were part of that.
My name is Chantal Fiola. I am a Chief Red River Métis. My mom's community is the historic Métis community of St. Laurent.
Niki Dishnikashan, ni mama igwa, ni baba take, and michif nia. My name is Nikki Ferland. I'm a Métis woman. Both my parents are Métis. I'm from Lorette, Manitoba, and I now live in Winnipeg with my wife and our daughter. It was especially important, I think, for Chantal as a Midewan woman to have a Wita'gaewin ceremony.
Wita'gaewin translating to union of the souls.
But what's unique about ours was that it was two-spirit, like it was a queer wedding, and then in addition to that, that Chantal and I are both Métis. That was really important to us because it was part of what had brought Chantal and I together was that we were on these individual ceremonial journeys. And we sort of connected over that. And so it was really important for us, you know, as a couple, to continue that journey, that spiritual journey together, and to raise our daughter in that way as well. We reached out to Ron immediately when we became engaged.
Our friend, Ron Indian Mandaman, who is a two-spirit chief of the Midewan Lodge in Shoal Lake First Nation, Ontario, conducted the Wita'gaewin ceremony for us. He was so helpful in preparing us. It was like a year-long preparation.
For some of the components of this ceremony, it was really especially important that we start early because an eagle, a grandmother, was a part of that ceremony, and so we had to work with conservation to make that happen, of course, and to get connected with that grandmother.
And there were special roles that our friends and family had to play, and that needed preparation as well. And thankfully, this happened before COVID so that we could actually meet in person. So our families gathered and prepared to sweat together. We gathered for like a cedar brushing ceremony and we were able to be in each other's presence. And of course, we talked through Zoom and on the phone. And we visited Ron at his house as well, where he passed teachings to us and was always there to answer any questions that we had and helped along the way.
I remember in the lead up to the day that I was so concerned because I had, you know, created this like agenda for how the day was supposed to go. And I remember Ron kept saying, you know, it could take an hour, it could take 2 hours, it could take 3 hours. Like, we're in ceremony. I can't put a timeline on it, right? And
you have, you know, all these expectations and it seems like a lot of pressure. And we had been preparing for what felt like so long. And, you know, you just want it to be perfect. But then when the smudge is lit, and the ceremony begins, those medicines have a way of kind of stilling your mind and your spirit and just opening up your heart. And that's happening for everybody who's participating. So we're participating as a unit, and you can feel your ancestors, your relatives' spirit there. And so the nervousness goes away, and I was able to just concentrate on the beautiful ceremony and this big step that we were taking together.
We had to prepare these Witigewin baskets. So over a year, Chantel and I collected essentially these things that were, you know, important to us, like photographs or, you know, knickknacks from our life and our travel and all of these other things in this basket that during the ceremony we shared with each other. And it was really this, the significance was, you know, sharing these pieces of ourselves with each other and then becoming responsible for each other's baskets. And then mothers had a very special role as well in the ceremony. So there was an archway in the facing the west direction that we walked through as part of that Witigewin ceremony, and our mothers got together and sort of made this arch, you know, planted these trees, you know, bent them, and then decorated that arch. So it was really lovely. And then in addition to that, the mothers had this special role of actually walking us through that arch. And so, you know, you see in more mainstream wedding ceremonies that typically that role is relegated to fathers, but it was our mothers who got to walk us through. So that was a really special moment for us as well.
Not only were we uniting our spirits, but also we were uniting the spirits of our ancestors and of our descendants.
Ron, when he started that ceremony, he brought the ancestors into that place. And it was really beautiful because afterwards, actually, one of Chantel's relatives said, you know, well, who was that woman who was like standing behind you on the deck? We were sort of right in front of a pond. And we said, well, there was no woman in front of us. Like, there was just a fire in front of us. And she said, I'm sure it was my mother. And so she had been able to, like, manifest or visualize this ancestor who had come. But I still strongly felt like our people were there, too, watching over us and lending their support to, you know, our union and our marriage and our relationship. So that was so special for me.
Ron Indian Mandaman carries these teachings and a wealth of knowledge. And he shared with us like Two-Spirit specific teachings. So I never really felt like we had to modify things in a way to like make them fit because we're queer or we're both women, which is, I think, so beautiful. The ceremonies and the teachings about us and a love like ours already exist, you know, and have since as long as humans have been around.
Breaking your own homes. I try. I'm the spitting image, you can see it in my eyes. Even in my pain, I can feel it in my bones. In the game that unlocks the code, I am living what I fear, like the autosave. Not trying to save the day. Something popping in my DNA, dropping on the first take. That is for ways, giving thanks for my fans who do not uphold the state. String of lights illuminate from an east to west stage. Rock out, don't wait. Dropping my hits when I'm in this to get rich. We dodge the passage, shit with grit. Take the knowledge out my pocket. On to the next, on to the next.
Don't play their games. When they see you on it, they'll steal your moves. Keep holding on to those deep roots. One day you'll be ancestors too. Even when you can't feel it, baby, know that they're a part of you. Don't you know that you're sacred, baby, and our ancestors are holding you.
That was G.R. Grit and Ancestors. Grit is a Juno Award-winning two-spirit transgender Francophone Anishinaabe Métis artist. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, claiming two-spirit identity and reclaiming space in cultural and community circles. When I think about the two-spirit youth in Canada today, I think about Joshua Whitehead. Joshua is a member of the Peguis First Nation in Manitoba. In March 2021, he became the first Indigenous writer to win Canada Reads for his compelling debut novel, Johnny Appleseed. It's an intimate portrayal of a young two-spirit man who lives in the big city and makes his way home to his reserve. And let me tell you, it had this auntie blushing several times. Joshua, who is two-spirit himself, has earned praise for his ability to weave heartbreak and beauty into his writing, and for representing Indigiqueer and two-spirit characters as real, honest, and whole. Welcome, Joshua.
Hello, hello. Thank you for calling me young. My Friendship Center still recognizes me as a youth, so I'm very happy to hear that.
Well, you're certainly younger than this auntie. Just saying.
Auntie in the making over here.
So tell me about what was it like for you growing up as a two-spirit person?
So I actually didn't claim two-spirit until I was in my mid-20s, about 25. Growing up in Selkirk, Manitoba, as well as Peguis First Nation, both in Treaty 1, being queer or two-spirit and Indigenous were just difficult things to enmesh together. I lived in a fairly, I would say, white and Indigenous segregated town. And then coming into my teens and my early 20s, I cling to words like gay or queer. But moving into queer spaces as well was difficult. You would go to things like Halloween and they'd be wearing headdresses and you got fetishized on dating applications. So it was difficult because one, you're either fetishized or exoticized, or two, you saw like dead representations of yourself. So it took me a long time to kind of come together to say that not only does my queerness not hinder my indigeneity, but in fact, it's like a symbiote. It really enhances it. And it was all through the finding of two-spirit that really kind of called me back into my body as a whole self.
Oh my gosh, so much of your story is just resonating with me. I'm just nodding my head like a bobblehead here because, you know, when you grow up in these communities, your survival is at the top of your, you know, list of things to do that day. But did you find, like, did people react to you in a way that they knew you were different? And did you know you were different growing up?
I was very much, I would say, a visible queer as a kid, as much as I tried to hide it. I remember being threatened a lot by cousins or folks on the res that if I was going to, quote unquote, continue that G-A-Y-S-H-I-T, that I would get beat up. So I learned to hide it, suppress it a lot. And then in settler spaces, white spaces, I really kind of learned to suppress my indigeneity a lot because I internalized moving towards whiteness, I feel like, so that I could embrace my queerness. So I, yeah, definitely endured my, I would say, share of hardship and coping mechanisms to get me through to where I am today. But I'm sure child Josh is just so happy to see this Josh living and thriving as a two-spirit person.
Aw, I love that. And so you had said that when you came to the city, there was this idea of what gay Indians were. And then you discovered the word two-spirit. Tell me about how you came to find that space.
So I actually came across the word two-spirit, not from community. I was taking in my master's at the University of Winnipeg, a course on trans narratives. And we came across this poet, Max Valerio, who identified as two-spirit. And I remember having very intense, difficult conversations as I was also trying to unlearn, you know, my white-centered gender binary and sex binary about what two-spirit means. I remember going home and asking family and aunties about it. And they're like, actually, we do have words for this in Cree. And I just remember thinking about, like, this is exactly who I am, that I'm both, you know, an OG Cree diehard, but then I'm also a queer femme who, you know, like likes to wear booty shorts and shake it at the club. So I think for me, like learning that was just like this kind of everything got sucked into like the black hole of who Joshua is and just kind of exploded from there, like another little big bang for Josh.
I liked how you said it was like an explosion. I was just picturing this explosion of glitter.
Well, you know, I am the self-ordained glitter princess, so that seems very apropos.
Exactly. That's what I was saying. So what were those words? Do you mind sharing what those words were that identified this idea of two-spirit?
So, yeah, the big one for me was the Peo Wiskaiwiskat, which means like a femme man. That one was the one that registered with me. Because, you know, for so long people asked, well, how do you identify? And I went by gay and I just felt so limiting because gay was so white. Putting it into Cree-ness, putting it into Nehiyawiwin for me is the most kind of sovereign way to kind of lay claim to my identity and then my ancestral star path that I followed, I think.
That's beautiful that you've, you know, pushed that journey a little further down the path from two-spirit. And you used two phrases to identify with. You use two-spirit and indigiqueer, which I love. How are these identities related?
So I take some fault with two-spirit at times. I think it can be harmful. I think it can be romanticized by Indigenous folks. I was just having a lot of conversations the other day for Trans Day of Remembrance where folks kept interpolating or seeing me as trans because they Google two-spirit and it means masculine and feminine spirits and they think that means trans or non-binary, and those are not terms I use for myself. So indigiqueer works for me too because I think it's a contemporary braiding of those two worlds, queer and Indigenous. I think of it as a placeholder for folks finding terminologies within their own language systems to name themselves and to claim themselves and to again honor all those people who came before us who were the most badass indigiqueers to have ever existed and made space for us to be here today. And I'm sure are like shining and beaming that we are all kind of coming together and having conversations like this.
So why do you think it's been or is so difficult for Indigenous people to accept themselves as two-spirit or indigiqueer or however they want to name themselves?
I think a lot of it is that we still live in like the haunting specter of settler colonialism. One, to kind of go back to kind of the dawning of powers on Turtle Island, such as the painter George Catlin, who depicts the literal hunting of two-spirit people and called two-spirit people the most disgusting thing he's ever seen in quote-unquote Indian country. Flash forward to residential schools. And these are conversations I've had to have, you know, with fatherly figures in my life, asking them to unthink and unpack their homophobia, their femphobia, their transphobia. And I think a lot of that comes from a lot of discussions that we haven't yet had about residential schools, which are so detailed around same-sex sexual assault. And I think that really helped demonize what we might call indigiqueerness now. And I think we're undoing a lot of those conversations. I've had folks tell me that Johnny Appleseed helped them have conversations with their own family. And so it's hard, difficult work. And I think we're doing it, we've done it, and we will continue to unpack and make space for our two-spirit indigiqueer kin because we need them more than ever.
Absolutely. I was speaking with Alex Wilson about this idea of two-spiritness and what it means in our community. And she talked about coming in. Of course, there are two parts to a circle, the inside and the outside. Yeah. And right now, you know, queer people, gay people, LGBT, Indigenous people are missing still. Why do you think that is? Why is it so difficult for Indigenous communities to accept that, you know, we are part of that circle and that we've been taken out?
I think a lot of it has to do with again, that residential school narrative. And I think a lot of it also has to do with who we center and who we uphold. I mean this as no shade. I have the highest level of respect for these folks, but you know, Indigenous cis men have been given the most precedence to healing throughout the TRC conversations. In grassroots work, like we still acknowledge MMIW are missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, but in larger kind of international, in terms of thinking about nations, Indigenous nations, I see that 2S dropped off all the time. So like, I think that's been, and it will be, a lifelong journey slash conversational battle of mine, is to really drill into the heads of folks that the longer you make us wait, the more we'll die off, and we are being murdered at accelerated rates. And we have, you know, incredibly high Indigenous youth suicides, many of whom are Two-Spirit or queer. And we don't have the time to wait to have that conversation. We need to have it now, because these folks will be leaders in our future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you have allowed that conversation because of your amazing book, Johnny Appleseed. In fact, it won Canada Reads, right? And in the lead up to Canada Reads, you spoke with Ganawage actor Devery Jacobs, who championed your book. And we're just going to play part of that conversation. I'm sure you remember it.
I'm queer. I'm Ngwehungwe. I'm Ganyutgehaga. So I'm a queer Mohawk woman, and sometimes it feels like these two things can't exist and they can't intersect, especially when it comes to the work that I'm doing. And in your novel, Johnny says, "I played straight on the res in order to be Indian, and I hear I played white in order to be queer." And this resonated like so deeply.
So Joshua, tell me more about this survival strategy of separating these two aspects of yourself.
Yeah, I guess for me, like the survival strategy was the survival strategy of assimilation and cultural genocide. And also the legacy I think we hold as queer people of also living in a kind of intensity of a pandemic that is not COVID, but is HIV and AIDS, right? We still kind of hold mm-hmm. that legacy with us. So there's a difference, I think, for me, was to be able to kind of play Indigenous in Indigenous spaces, which kind of meant amping up my masculinity and, you know, like speaking Resi and wanting to learn to hunt and trying to move into those spaces. And then in my queer spaces, which I think the women of my Indigenous family recognized, was that I was more comfortable and accustomed to like being in the kitchen and drinking red rose tea and making bannock and like hearing all the snake stories. And, you know, like hitting each other when you laugh, all that fun stuff.
I'd be hitting you right now if we were in the same place.
We'd be bruised after this conversation. and then on the opposite side, I would say, like, to survive in, you know, a heterosexual, cisgender, white world, I couldn't be Indigenous. Queerness would be allowed, but only if you were touching whiteness at all times. And it's an unfortunate coping mechanism, but it is one that I had to use to survive.
Do you see more widespread recognition and acceptance of Two-Spirit community today?
I do, actually, which gives me such hope. So I went home to Pegwis, First Nation, my home res, right before the pandemic hit. And then we went to Fisher River Powwow. And my auntie works there on the schools. And we had to go get some money to get some powwow food, right? Because you just can't not get an Indian taco and a snake blanket.
Right.
So we went to this cultural center that my auntie, again, is a part of and works with. And we got out, and there was like all these youth. You know, just like me mugging, you know, being Resi. And then they were like, "Oh my God, that's Joshua Whitehead." And I just got like flocked by all these youth who were just so adorable and so cute. But also I was just like, wow, like this is amazing for me to see that you're like visibly queer and like non-binary and you're so steadfast in your identities and you're so young. That I was like, this is like the future that I want to see, the future that I was trying to build, and we're getting there, and you are just like utopic seeds ripe for planting, and everyone who's going to follow in your wake and everyone you touch is going to be so transformed.
That is amazing to have that kind of reception when you go home. And as you said, do you think that it was because you wrote a book like Johnny Appleseed? How important is it for you young people to see Indigiqueer characters like them, maybe?
Yeah, I can speak for myself. So like the youth, they all asked for signatures, and they all told me like that we have been watching what you've been doing with Johnny Appleseed. And then when Canada Reads was airing, I got all these DMs on Facebook, all across folks from Peguis, and I had Chief and Council message me, and just folks thanking me, specifically the younger ones on Instagram, being like, because of Johnny Appleseed and because me and my family watched it and we got to see how it also wasn't just about you, it was about others with Devery, and how that moved and transformed Devery, that we've been able to have conversations with family, and now I can say I'm like a proud two-spirit or indigiqueer person, and like that, like what, like that is just such a gifting. Such a gifting. And to think that, you know, a little 10-year-old, 12-year-old Josh, who was completely wounded by the world, could be here doing that now. I'm speechless almost. I don't know what to say, but I'm incredibly grateful and incredibly thankful. And, you know, winning accolades and winning Canada Reads is great and all. But that right there, that is the ultimate win to me.
Mm-hmm. So your gift to them was the book, and now their gift to you is acceptance. That is an amazing medicine bundle that you have given them.
Okay, now we're getting emotional. It is a beautiful medicine bundle. And I couldn't do it, you know, without the, you know, the queer and two-spirit aunties and uncles who like came before me.
Well, let's cast our visions into the future, Joshua. Close your eyes and daydream with me. Think about what it's going to look like 20 years from now for our indigiqueer youth and for the circle as a whole. Mm-hmm. What do you see?
Well, I see these youth who have been coining amazing terms like indigigamer, G-A-Y-M-E-R, indigigoths, indigi-everything, that is just like so amazingly queer and so amazingly punk. So what I see is specifically with Gen Z, and they're like being birthed into this very activist moment and living through the most historical moment that we'll have all have lived through, which is this pandemic, and also having, you know, access, which is what I don't think I had when I was a kid, to, you know, indigiqueer aunties or two-spirit uncles or mushrooms and cookums. I see in 20 years down the line that these are going to be monumental and fundamental leaders in all of our communities who will be on the front lines and will be making political and policy changes both on the reserve and in our Indigenous nations and in this larger nation state that we exist in. And they have the fire of all fires that I've ever seen. So I think I'm just ready to sit back, write a couple more books, and just like watch the nation blaze.
Thank you so much for your time today, Joshua, and your wisdom.
Oh, always, always thank you, Auntie Rowe.
Joshua Whitehead is a member of Peguis First Nation, Manitoba. He's a writer, scholar, lecturer, editor, and glitter princess. That's our time here on Unreserved. This episode was produced by Aaron Knoll, Kim Kasher, Laura Bone-Stubing, Roshni Nair, and me, Rosanna Deerchild. Shout out to the City of Winnipeg, who made a great video of Anishinaabe Elder Myra Laramie telling the story of her two-spirit dream. You can see it on our website, and special thanks to Myra herself for giving us permission to share it. If you want to hear more Unreserved, you can find us on our website at cbc.ca/unreserved. Download the podcast on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ginasknamit Nawi, Egosay.